politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen, standing at the ready to fight anew the issues that matter in the way they matter at the time they matter here on this Thursday, another dreary early April day. And as this week really develops after the Easter holiday, it's kind of slow. I figured we'll take the time out, as we've done throughout the week, going a little bit off topic from some of our main activism items. Obviously, Congress is going to get back into session next week to screw us yet again. So I figured I'd turn to foreign policy. You know, we talk a lot about the fact that we could pretty much influence everything if we had true leaders at the red state level, a movement that was focused, that had some brains and beliefs and energy and wasn't lazy and dumb. There's a lot we can do. Foreign policy is probably the thing that's the most out of our hands. And, you know, it's not just foreign policy, because it does spill over with Biden's war on Israel, okay? And their embrace of Iran, their embrace of Islamism, that certainly affects us here at its core. It's immigration, but it's also the elevation of Islam in America. I don't think we've ever seen this degree of political and street muscle flexed by Muslims in America ever, the way we've seen since October 7th. So we're going to have a special guest coming up to kind of just give stock 6 months later where we are in Israel in terms of militarily, politically, and all the ways the Biden administration is essentially funding a color revolution in Israel. And of course, the vision Republicans should be giving, which is deter all of and defund all of Biden's policies rather than try to sweeten the pot of Ukraine funding by throwing in Israel funding, which is stupid because we're funding Hamas and we're funding Gaza and we're funding the war in Israel. So what's the point anyway? So we'll touch on that coming up a little later. I did want to start out just again with what I talked about yesterday about Ukraine. So Tucker did finally do a show on Johnson's bid to fund Ukraine another $60 billion, or however he wants to do it, a mixture of freezing Russian assets and this so-called lend-lease program. So he did have Marjorie Taylor Greene on the show, and I didn't watch most of it, but I just saw it. So, you know, finally, okay, he is warning about Johnson's effort. But that's only half the story. I look at it, and just like with the vaccines, he doesn't imbue it with an Esther moment. Okay? In other words, he doesn't take it to the king, to the man at top. He acts as if this came on its own. And I cannot relate to this. Let me know. Email me, danielhorowitz@starmail.com. What am I missing? Why is there this reluctance to take it to the top? Again, there's no primary anymore that, oh, I can't be viewed as criticizing Trump because it might harm his ability to defeat DeSantis, and God forbid, should we have someone better as our nominee. I mean, look, that's over with. He is the nominee. You're not going to lose it. So now you may as well utilize the benefit of having Trump, right? What, I mean, what's the point in going scorched earth, destroying DeSantis, lying about him, obfuscating all of Trump's flaws? Well, I, you know, for whatever reason, you felt he was the best guy. Fine, you got him. But what's the point in getting him to actually wield influence and change bad policies? Well, here's the deal. You don't have to wait until Trump is president. Right here and right now, there cannot be more Ukraine funding without the Republican House agreeing to it. The Republican House cannot agree to it if Trump actively opposes it, like he did in the past. But why is everyone ignoring the fact that this is coming from him? And this has been already for 7 weeks, that Trump has agreed to this, and that's roughly the time frame that Johnson has been pushing this. For those of you who don't remember, I'm going to play a minute clip here. This is from Trump in South Carolina, February 14th, so this was during the primary. Here's what he had to say about this idea of lending the money to Ukraine for more aid. Take a listen here.
More, $60 billion with a B. They want to give him $60 billion more. And I said, wait a minute, do it this way. Loan them the money. If they can make it, they pay us back. If they can't make it, they don't have to pay us back. Loan them the money. Put it as a form of a loan. Why should you just hand it over to them? Do it as a form of a loan. I do that with athletes. They can't quite, you know, like a professional golfer who I think is very good. They don't have any money, but they have a lot of talent. I'll say, here's the deal. I did it with a number of people. Here's the deal. What I want to do, professional golfer, I play golf. I play very nice. Did you see the picture of me, the horrible picture with the stomach out to here? That was... So what I do is I'm putting up today a picture of me actually, what I actually look like, hitting a ball, smashing the frickin' ball. And you'll see, quite... I wouldn't say slim. I wouldn't say slim, but not bad. But the ball does go far. I would say it goes about 9 times further than Biden can hit it 9 times.
All right, folks. So there's a lot to unpack there. He says if they can't pay it back, then fine. So first of all, it's not just the fiscal cost. Why are we risking more war against Russia in a theater that we can't win, that it's already collapsed? I mean, even if you believed in the cause, throwing out more money when the entire world has already indulged them more than any nation in history is not going to change the dynamic. There's no way you're going to reclaim the lost land. That's just not going to happen. And I thought Trump recognized that. So I don't even know what that means. And then he ventures off into professional golf. And then his personal golf ball, slim. What's with the L's? Is that some sort of vaccine injury? But anyway, this is what he is, like half retardation, half off the mark, this and that, all about him. And then he just goes back on even something that he was pretty consistent on beforehand. And you got to start asking yourself, why is Trump inexorably moving to the left, even on things that he clearly was on the other side? Meaning, it almost sounds like there's a gun to your head and you're compelled to do it. Okay, it's better to do a lend-lease than blank check, but we all know that you can't pay it back anyway, so it will be a blank check. But there is no gun to your head. You're not compelled to do it. You don't have to initiate a new bill in the House. You already gave away the farm on the budget. Why do that? Where did this come from? And the thing is, if you look at the preponderance of evidence of Trump's behavior with some of these endorsements, with the Bud Light thing, for example, Doug Burgum just did a big fundraiser for Trump. He's trying to buy himself Interior Secretary under Trump. Imagine that, a global warming guy as Interior Secretary. Why all of a sudden this relationship? Because Doug Burgum brings in Bill Gates adjacent money. Clearly there are moneyed interests that are demanding this of him. So we've come full circle Animal Farm Orwellian, where the man who was elevated based on the promise that I don't need money so I can't be bought off, now he's landing in the swampiest of places to get money. And what this demonstrates is this will not change. Both in terms of Trump's modus operandi, but also the modus operandi of his supporters and biggest influencers, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson. They're not going to pressure him. This is the bizarre behavior a lot of us lived through when he was president. We would have bad policies flow from the admin, flow from the Republican Party, flow from the Speaker, Speaker Ryan, Mitch McConnell. And everyone's like, oh, what the heck? And I was like, well, you kind of have the man as president you know, one of two things is true. Either he's directly doing this or he's okay with it and not fighting it. So if he's amazing, he's the man at the top, you have influence with him. What's the point in saying Mitch McConnell sucks, Paul Ryan sucks, Steve Mnuchin, Jared Kushner, take it to the man? It was so weird. We lived through this for 4 years. And now it's only gotten worse. They've become even less reluctant or more reluctant to just gently pressure him. Again, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I appreciate your motion to vacate Johnson. I support it. I appreciate your stance on Ukraine. But if you really want to affect an outcome, don't you need to pick up the phone and call the man himself? I mean, Johnson has already demonstrated that he doesn't care what we think. He's willing to pass a bill with the Democrats. There's even a thought now that even if we did motion to vacate, he's so advantageous to the Democrats might actually vote for him over Hakeem Jeffries and vote to save him. Again, it is what it is. It's out of our hands. But this is the thing. This is off to the races. And let me give you another example. Even before pushing Ukraine, Punchbowl is reporting this morning that even before that, his bigger priority, what he might push next week, rather than Ukraine, that might be the week after, is FISA reauthorization. I mean, what the heck? At a time when the FBI is just spying on people in order to investigate political opponents, you're going to reauthorize their ability to, you know, monitor your communications without a judicial warrant, violate the Fourth Amendment? After all the abuse we've seen? Again, this whole business, slim majority of just one house. Okay, that's an argument that I can't, you know, enact new good policy. But the notion that you have to pass a bad bill when you, at the end of the day, control the rules and the floor of the house is absurd. Again, a call from Trump against FISA reauthorization. I mean, heck, he was a victim of this. I just don't get it. Why are we allergic to using the very means and methods and strategies that we have at our disposal that will actually achieve the outcome we say we all want? What is the point of elevating him as the Führer of the movement? I mean, not just the president, but I mean the king of the party and the movement, if you're not going to use him for the good and, in fact, allow him to skate away by tacitly or sometimes directly supporting bad things without holding him accountable. For the life of me, I don't get it. And I'm just telling you, you look ahead and I see both see, this whole business of Trump saving us is built upon three flawed premises. Number one, that he's likely to win. Number two, that he's likely to orient himself towards our goals. And number three, even if he did, even if he was amazing, there's just, you got to focus on the red states. It's just, it's not enough that it's going to save us. Whoever would be president, even DeSantis. And that's why this notion that we're putting all of our eggs in that basket and sometimes sacrificing the other things, where we elevate bad GOP governors and bad candidates to accommodate him. All for what? This is why the focus now needs to be on the likelihood that we're going to need to build a bulwark in the red states against the Fourth Reich. And that's why things like the South Carolina legislative primaries are the most important thing we could focus on. Because it will be bad. It will be really bad. I mean, there's a ton of polls out now. Everything was but the polls. So fine, I'll look at the polls. They show Biden ahead. And again, a lot of the ones that show some avenue for Trump to win, it's all based on RFK and Jill Stein and Kanye West getting on the ballot and remaining in there. and somehow Democrats voters will stick with them, when the reality is now, you know, no one loves Biden, but when it boils down to it, Democrats tend to not like wasting their vote. So if that's what you're counting on, it's possible. But if you're counting on that, it's a stupid game. Stupid strategy. Anyway, today our sponsor is Raycon. You know, it's often tough to think of gifts. You got birthdays, anniversaries, and then Mother's Day is around the corner now. Raycon is running a special promotion for Mother's Day, 20% off their everyday earbuds at buyraycon.com/conservative. Makes a terrific Mother's Day gift. I particularly plan on getting one for my wife because they have a noise isolation mode. And you certainly need that when you have screaming kids in your ears all day, as she certainly does. And I know a lot of your wives or mothers might have that as well. Raycon's everyday earbuds, they feel great. The audio quality is on par with the expensive premium brands, except it's much cheaper than any premium brand. Plus, you go to buyraycon.com/conservative, you get 20% off your order plus free shipping. So it really makes it on par with cheapy brands with the optimal premium quality, 8 hours of playtime, 32-hour battery life. So you could bring it on trips, you know, plane rides with you easily, you know, until you get to your hotel room. They have three customizable sound profiles. They have noise isolation, but also awareness mode. So, you know, you're not walking down like a zombie on the street, ripe to get knocked out by a criminal. And their fit is perfect. It's the only earbuds that fit in my ears. I always have trouble with that, and it would make a terrific Mother's Day gift. It's right around the corner. And by the way, in case all your siblings have the same idea, Raycon offers an easy 30-day return policy, so you could return them. Go to buyraycon.com/conservative today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, 20% off at buyraycon.com/conservative. That's buyraycon.com/conservative. So I just want to round off this point. It's a great transition into our guest, you know, talking about the Intifada, Israel, Hamas, and Muslims living in the West supporting Hamas and subverting Western civilization. You know, you want to look at what the antithesis of MAGA influence is. That's the left, particularly the Muslim left. A couple weeks ago at a rally, Biden had gave a healthcare speech in Raleigh, North Carolina. And he was interrupted by a pro-Gaza protester, started heckling him. And I guess I don't have the audio here, but I guess the context was that, you know, the people were, you know, maybe starting to rough him up or boo him, like you know, shout him down because he was interrupting. And again, for all the talk about how senile Biden is, when on the issues that matter in the way they matter at the time they matter to the left, he actually is very lucid, a lot more lucid than our leaders and people. And he said, quote, he said to his audience, be patient with them, meaning the protest, be patient with them. They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into Gaza. And I was thinking, you know, this guy is the most pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, pro-Islamic murderer. I mean, here you have the biggest slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust, and you side with the guys doing the slaughter as an American president, American administration, and they drive a hard negotiation. That's not enough. They're like, no, we want to hear you say it blatantly. We don't like this kind of background screwing with Israel quietly. We want you to do it publicly and, you know, say Israel's genocidal and, you know, that type of stuff. And Biden responds to the pressure. Like, yeah, you know, like they got a point. Despite the fact that they interrupt him and, you know, block his motorcade, and it works. That's why the Democrat Party is so awesome. I'm saying they'll primary kind of the old guard Democrats that are 100% leftist voting record, but they just might not be up on the latest talking points. In other words, they're communist, fiscal, social, open borders, homosexual agenda, but they're not like quite, they're like, look, you know, you can't slaughter Israelis or something like that's just not okay. You know, I believe in the two-state solution and all that, but you know, Israel does kind of have the right to exist in some capacity. And they're like, no, what the hell? You know, we're primarying you. And often they're pretty successful at it. That's what a movement looks like. Everyone's like, oh, you know, we have idolatry with Trump just like they did with Obama. No, wait, no, it's 10 times worse. There was no idolatry around Obama. The idolatry was around their cause. They pressured him when they felt he wasn't deporting enough people. I'm sorry that he was deporting too many people. They called him deporter in chief. And he responded. He was like, look, you know, I was focused on Obamacare. He was mainly focused on the economic fiscal stuff, the dependency, you know, remaking of America's society and economy. He wasn't so focused on the immigration issue. So during his first term, ICE was still operating, you know, the way they did. But, you know, they got in his case and he made a pledge for a second term and he responded. And that's when he did DACA and, you know, all that stuff and suspended enforcement. That's what a movement looks like. Always, always want more. To us, forget about more. We could get nothing from our guys. We could get negative. They could downright openly take the wrong side on an issue. Say I'm for lend lease. Slim, if they don't pay it back, that's okay. And we're totally fine with it.
Like, hey, what's with Johnson? Why is Johnson doing this?
Well, I mean, Trump blessed it. Why don't you take the fight to him?
Shut up, Daniel. Do you want Biden? Huh? Do you want Biden?
What the hell does that have to do with anything? I mean, what do you mean, do I want Biden? We have a long time till the election. We have 7 months to the election. Plenty of time to pick up the phone publicly and privately. You tell him it's unacceptable. And if you did that more times than not, he changes mind. He changes his mind. Guess what? It'll be very hard for House Republicans to pass that bill. But no, there's no pressure, like just like there wasn't on the omnibus bill. So that's where we are domestically. But I do want to get just to delve into what is going on in Israel, what the State Department and the CIA are doing there. And it demonstrates just how ruthless they are. So folks, some days I have to pinch myself to realize this is not a nightmare. This is not alternative reality. We're actually living through a regime, an American regime, that hates us. They hate us. They hate our values. It's almost like a controlled demolition. What sort of government would actively work with NGOs to invade its own country? What sort of government would push vaccines 3 years into all of the data we have on it? It's actually a lot more I want to talk about tomorrow. More studies that have come out, just the shocking prevalence, the ubiquitous nature of the cardiovascular injuries. I mean, what sort of government would do that? Well, the same government that would take a look at the October 7th attacks in Israel and literally side with the perpetrators. I mean, this is what has been going on. We have our government utilizing our resources towards basically building for another event like that that will probably be bigger. My biggest takeaway, and I want to get the sense from our next guest, but my biggest takeaway 6 months later is that for years Israel tolerated what no other developed nation would do when it's under attack from a barbaric enemy. They would just allow endless attacks, rocketing on a daily occurrence, because, well, it only killed 10s and 20s. And we always thought that, look, God forbid this should happen, but if it ever happened that there would be a mass slaughter, then finally this would come to an end. And October 7th came, and we all thought that. But very quickly, within hours, and this was, by the way, even before Israel technically did anything in response, because they had a delay of about 2 weeks there, the entire Arab world got the entire Western governing media complex on their side, which is in itself an extraordinary story. And it's now flipped upside down. I mean, unless you're an American conservative, and then even then we have some bizarre reactionary elements in certain influential circles adopting leftist talking points, but for the most part, the right is still sane in America, that believes that somehow an enemy could attack, hide among civilians exclusively, and then you can't do anything in response to get rid of them so they don't do it again. And not only that, the Biden administration is working with the Israeli leftists, again, all with our State Department CIA resources, to have Antifa sort of riots that are now ubiquitous all over Israel in an open effort to take down Netanyahu. And I don't know if this is just a function of the fact that Republicans have made it so easy for Biden to screw up America that he's kind of bored with that, so he's taking his show on the road. Who knows? But I wanted to delve deep into this 6 months later. What's going on there? What lessons we could take out? It's also important, again, as Johnson pushes a Ukraine bill and will probably try to sweeten the pot for conservatives and throw in some money for Israel, to understand that if you are pro-Israel and, more importantly, putting America first, it's not a funding problem. It's more of a policy problem that needs to be deterred in any such bill. So with us to discuss this is a terrific guest we had on a couple months ago, Yoram Hezani. He's a leader of the national conservatism movement, really globally. He's the chairman of the Edmund Burke Foundation, chairman of the Herzl Institute. He's also the author of an important book that you'll want to read, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. He is an Israeli, but he really fell in love with America when he went to Princeton for college in the 80s. He was the first editor of their conservative publication. You could follow him at Y Hazani, Y-H-A-Z-O-N-Y on Twitter. And he's with us in the flesh today for the second time. Hey, welcome back for the second time to Blaze Media.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. There's a lot to unpack there. So there's militarily, there's politically. Let's just start off militarily on the ground. What is the state of play? It looked like Israel was dismantling them. They killed like two-thirds of Hamas leadership and soldiers. But then they kind of telegraph their punches because they feel the pressure. They pull some punches. They're getting hit with human rights violations left and right. But then Hamas is still there in Rafah. Where do you see things militarily at this point?
Well, the most important thing to understand is that Israel is fighting a multi-front war. So the most of the news covers Gaza for obvious reasons, because that's a small piece of territory that the Hamas controls and that Israel has invaded and has occupied most of it. But we need to remember that at the same time that there are ongoing active military operations in Gaza, Israel is fighting a daily missile war, primarily with the Hezbollah on the Lebanese border and on the Golan Heights. Right, so we have soldiers engaged in an active war, and I'm not talking about exchange of fire occasionally. I'm talking about every single day there are attacks on a dozen or two dozen cities in the north. We have close to 100,000 people who've been evacuated from the north, and that's a war situation that is not.
100,000 people are still evacuated?
Yes, most of the towns, 10 kilometers. I mean, all the towns, 10 kilometers or so from the within 10 kilometers of the northern border, the Lebanese border, have been completely evacuated, and the people are living in hotels. And so it's very important to understand that the Israeli public is not just focused on Gaza. It's also focused on the fact that a very, very large number of people can't go back to their homes because of the northern war that's going on every night.
So they have this low intensity conflict where they don't do enough that Israel would be greenlit to actually have a full scale counterattack. So Biden could say, hey, well, you know, they didn't attack. I kept them at bay. So you have no right to do anything. But in fact, you're taking 100,000 people, which to scale for the American population would be several million. In a tiny country where you can't live in your northern part of it, when the southern part, southwest part, is already a militarized zone that is, disrupted on a daily basis from civilian life. So that's in itself is kind of an act of war, right?
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said, except maybe for the expression low intensity, because the fact that Israel hasn't yet decided on the timing for an invasion of Lebanon doesn't mean that it's not imminent. The Israeli public and the Israeli government believes that there is going to be an invasion of Lebanon, and low intensity doesn't describe what is in effect tanks and missiles and drone combat every day on a very large scale. So if there weren't a war in the south in Gaza at this moment, then Israel would already have invaded Lebanon. Okay, so everybody needs to understand that the Israeli public and the Israeli government think this is imminent. At the same time, there are other fronts. We had apparently a hit on an Israeli naval base. It didn't do any damage, but a drone attack from Iraq that just 2 days ago that hit an Israeli naval base in Eilat. And at the moment, the country is on high alert for the first time because of reported threat of direct missile or drone attack from Iran, right? This is a new situation that we haven't seen in the last 6 months, where Iran has apparently set in motion the possibility of a direct strike against Israel. So, this is before
Israel's,
we get into
Israel's paralyzed today. I'm reading the news. The GPSs are jammed. What's going on with that?
Well, it's not quite paralyzed, but it is true that if you try to use Waze or some other kind of GPS program to drive someplace in Israel, there is some chance that if you go too far south or too far north, your GPS will tell you that you're in Beirut. And the reason for this is that the part of the Israeli defense array is telling incoming GPS-guided weapons that they should be aimed at Beirut instead of aimed at the north of Israel. So, I mean, that's partly a deterrent. But you're right that
In other words, what I'm driving at is this, that to the extent you could put any sane, moral, intellectual argument behind those that are pressuring Israel, it would be something like, well, look, it was terrible what happened to you. You really killed out a lot of Hamas. The rockets from Hamas kind of, pretty much stopped. You didn't wipe them out completely. They're in Rafah in the southern part now, but you got most of them. But at this point, is it worth all those civilian casualties? Just pull out. You degraded them and go on living your lives and mind your own business, and everything will be fine.
Nobody. There's almost nobody in Israel who thinks that the initial goals of this war have been achieved. So let's talk a little bit about Rafiah. It's true that Israel has already conquered the city of Gaza and Khan Yunis and the other major centers of Hamas activity in Gaza. But the Israeli military estimates are that they've probably disabled something like 40% of the Hamas fighters. Okay, so I was
wrong about the two-thirds. So that's a different story. 40%.
Well, no. If you're talking about leadership, then you were right. If you're talking about the military commanders, battalion level commanders and brigade level commanders, if you're talking about those kinds of military leaders, then I think probably two-thirds of them have in fact been captured or killed. But the problem is that the certainly the majority of the Hamas fighters are still equipped and they're still organized and they're still capable of fighting. Most of them have apparently retreated to the southernmost town in the Gaza Strip, which is called Rafiah.
Yeah.
It's on the border with Egypt. And what's happened is that if you go back to, you know, the government's initial war aims that everybody in Israel knows them kind of by heart. Number one, destroy the Hamas. Number two, return the hostages. Number three, reconstruct politically the situation in and militarily in Gaza so that it's not possible for Hamas to return and threaten Israel again. So none of those three aims have been achieved because the Hamas leadership has retreated, apparently, together with most of their fighters and apparently with most of the hostages that they're still holding to this town of Rafiah.
And by the way, just so people know, it's not just incidental. There was a place that some of them happened to escape to. They knew from day one they were attacking from the north and that the south would be safe for a number of months. So they specifically went there. And that's part of Israel's, and I'm not blaming your leadership there. This is the problem of the Biden administration pressure and everything, where they're kind of caught in this middle ground where they ratcheted up the intensity of what they typically do after a Holocaust like that. So you get hit with all these, the civilian casualties, but actually they have been pulling punches and telegraphing their punches in order to avoid civilian casualties. And that has allowed the trunk of the tree to remain and a lot of the limbs so that if you would pull out now within a year or two, you could have a full, you know, fully grown tree back in service, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's important to understand what's going on, that the Biden administration is politically trapped, all right? And I think this is something that people, you know, even people who, you know, are Democrats can understand clearly the situation, not just people who are conservatives, that the new Democratic coalition includes a wing that is extremely sympathetic to, you know, what's the euphemism is progressivism, but it's basically these woke neo-Marxists together with a number of very active Islamic supremacists that we now have in the United States. And they're in the same party together with, you know, the majority of liberal Jews, most of whom, you know, are still in shock and horror over October 7th, and they want the administration to be supporting Israel. So now we're, whatever it is, 9 months from the election, and Biden's looking at the polls, and he's correctly seeing that if he loses the progressive and Muslim vote, or you know, I'm just a part of it in states like Michigan and other places where there's a significant Muslim population, then they're saying, well, we could lose the election over this war, so the war has to end. Okay, so that is, you know, they have to say that at the same time that they're telling their liberal Jewish supporters, especially, you know, some of their big donors, they're saying, no, we are supporting Israel. So politically, Biden has parked himself in what's really, really an untenable situation. I don't mean to be too sympathetic to it, but I think in order to understand, like, if Israel attains any of its goals, then Biden could lose the election over it. And he knows that. Like, this is consciously what's going on. Now, they have another option here that they seem to be actively pursuing, which is topple the Netanyahu government in the hope that that's going to prevent the Israeli government from attaining its war aims before the election. After the election is already a different question. So you see all of this, you know, Chuck Schumer declaring openly, you know, that the Israeli government needs to be deposed and overthrown, and we have going on in Israel. It's a small group. I mean, I should emphasize that all of our polling shows that the Israeli public is solidly behind the war. So the most recent polling is still 75% of the Israeli public is in favor of the Rafiah operation. 75% of the Israeli public rejects the Biden administration's call to establish a Palestinian state as, you know, as though that's going to create peace, as though we didn't already have a Palestinian state for you know, for 18 years in Gaza. And we know how that ends. But we're watching what is turned into a zero-sum game between Netanyahu and Biden, where in order to survive, Netanyahu has to achieve his war aims. I mean, even if you set aside for a second, I mean, I think that's the right thing to do. I think it's just. I think it's militarily sound. But just look at the voting public. 75% of Israelis want him to go into Rafah, and Biden is telling him, no, if you do that, I'm going to lose the election. And Bibi says, but if I don't do that, my government's going to collapse. Right. So I mean.
And then there's the other layer that suddenly we start to see. Remember, we had those kind of Antifa style, almost American style leftist protests that you had the previous year. October 7th obviously created unprecedented unity, put that to an end. But 6 months later, I'm seeing more news about rioting, and some of their leaders are claiming to be in touch with the White House. Do you believe that the White House is behind a sort of color revolution to work with Netanyahu's leftist opposition to create the disquiet in the street and then politically undermine him in the government?
You know, I don't actually know who in the White House is or isn't behind this, but I think that what we can see clearly, I think it's obvious, is that you're right, that the protests that we're seeing small, consistent, aggressive protests which use Black Lives Matter, Antifa type tactics, and these are happening simultaneously. So I wouldn't say necessarily in direct coordination, but certainly in indirect coordination with the Israeli Supreme Court, which is trying to bring down the Netanyahu government by declaring that Israel needs to revise the draft law, which, you know, this Israeli Supreme Court knows that could bring down the Netanyahu government. And at the same time, we have this, what appears to be, you know, like a Ukraine style or Georgia style color revolution. It doesn't look like Israeli protests. It looks like something that is being organized with advice and money and coordination from someplace abroad. And whether this is coming from, you know, from NGOs, from leftist NGOs, or whether it's actually coming from the CIA, from the State Department, you know, I have my bet what's happening. But it doesn't really matter in the end, because what's happening is the international left is working in unofficial coordination with the most aggressive parts of the Israeli left and with the apparent tacit approval, at least, of the Biden administration, which wants Netanyahu to fall. So, like, how many more dots do you need to connect here?
One other element of this that has shocked me from day one, and I wanted to get your sense of this, is what's appearing to be a hostage industry. So, I mean, the left is always good at using props and emotional pulls to impel terrible policies. But what I'm seeing internally in Israel, but it's the Biden administration is clearly involved in this as well, is that they're using families of hostages to be spokesmen. It's kind of like what we have here with these mass shootings, and they'll use the families of the victims. So like with Sandy Hook, it reminds me a little bit of that. And they use these families and they say, we need to give in to Hamas demands. I want my relatives back. You're going to get them killed. And you determine existential national survival policies, as you laid out at the beginning. I mean, this is a multi-front war. They have a big, big problem. They can't walk away from this based on the whims of a terrible situation of a couple of families. And I know, you know, there is a little bit of diversity among them, but I saw this, Caroline Glick wrote about this. Relatives of 10 of the 134 hostages wrote a letter declaring to return our loved ones. We have decided to work in the service of Hamas. We are demanding that the Israeli government accept the organization's demands immediately. If not, we will burn the country down. Now, look, obviously this was unprecedented what happened to these families, what happened on October 7th. But from day one, I was always a little bit befuddled at the degree of mobilization almost behind the hostage industries and the placards and the posters. I mean, we have them in the Jewish communities here in America. And again, there's nothing wrong in a vacuum with that part of it. But I was just a little bit surprised. And then I see that what is behind this?
Well, I probably, if I'm going to discuss this, I should mention that that my family also has a hostage in Gaza.
Really?
Yes. The life partner of one of my first cousins is a hostage in Gaza, and wow. Who was apparently, you know, as far as we know, she was still alive during the previous. Short ceasefire and hostage release, because the hostages said that she was alive and teaching yoga when they were there. So she may still be alive. So Israel's a small country. A lot of people are related to those hostages. And I think you're right that on the one hand, nobody in Israel wants to tell people who are relatives of hostages in Gaza to be quiet. You know, everybody understands that their first responsibility as family members is to do everything that they can to get their hostage their family members released.
Sure.
And everybody understands that. Everybody forgives it. You know, even if it's sometimes out of hand. On the other hand, the shameless exploitation of these families by these extreme left organizations. These extreme left organizations, before the war, they spent 9 months trying to topple the Netanyahu government, and at the time they were saying either that he was corrupt or that he was, a dictator, and that he was trying to overthrow the government by changing the judicial appointment process. Both of those accusations highly questionable. But the point is that these are people who already, the people organizing these demonstrations and riots, they were already trying to topple the government a year ago before the war. And so now they're just back at it again with more foreign assistance. And as you say, like one of their props is that they have, a small number of the hostage families that are willing to be used by them. I think it is really revolting, and I really think that the Israeli media should be more responsible about giving them a platform.
And that's a typical leftist tactic. I mean, they do it everywhere. We find it in America, whether it's crime stories, whether it's obviously the gun stuff. Just reminds me a lot of Sandy Hook, and some of this, it has to be very astroturfed by NGOs that exploit families, which obviously, look, if you have a loved one, I don't care about geopolitics. I care about getting my relative back. I just look out at this picture, and I'm trying to mine different lessons for our audience here. One of the things I've always lamented in America is that when we go to war, whatever the prudence of the war is, we always have this problem where we needlessly sacrifice the lives of our soldiers on the altar of a politically correct warfare, where we bean count so-called civilian casualties. And this happened for years in all of America's wars, and we needlessly lose good men for nothing. Do you have a counter to what I was just talking about the NGOs exploiting hostages? What about all the – how many service members have you lost?
During the kinetic operation in Gaza, meaning the invasion and conquest of Gaza, somewhere around 250. But we also have to count soldiers and police who died in battle, you know, within Israel during October 7th sure. and the week after that.
So, but 250 yeah. in the kinetic operation, and again, that's for a small country, like you said, everyone knows each other. So you had about that many hostages. You have that many people that went down in battle. These are young men, young people. So here's what I don't understand. In America, I've lamented for years that there's no skin in the game, right? There's no skin in the game. Very few people have family in the military, especially those that are in politics. So it's easy for them to sacrifice our people on the altar of political correctness. But I'm trying to figure out people like Benny Gantz and all these kind of leftist guys you have there. Don't all of their relatives serve? I mean, don't they have sons and certainly nephews and brothers and all sorts of people that are getting injured and dying and whatever? Does that play a role and create a gravitational pull politically towards not fighting a politically correct war?
You know, I don't think that Benny Gantz is as far left as the Biden administration may think. That he is. I mean, he has in the last few days called for new elections. That's not incredibly surprising because he's ahead in the polls. But as far as his commitment to these three war aims, he's been 100% committed. I haven't seen any wobbling from him at all. I mean, the irony of this is that the Biden administration, if it succeeds in toppling Netanyahu, Gantz is going to be in the same position that Netanyahu is, which is that 75% of the public wants to go into Rafah and is against a Palestinian state. And don't be surprised. That's going to be the position that Benny Gantz is going to end up taking as well.
But do you find, again, just more specifically, do you find that having skin in the game, that the broad Israeli public, including elected officials, they have very close relatives, including sons and children in the military. Does that have an effect?
Of course that has an effect. I have two sons and three nephews who've spent months in combat in the last few months.
Wow.
And I'm just like everybody else. I mean, everyone in the country is at war, and That's the reason that 75% of the country is insisting on prosecuting the war, despite the overwhelming pressure that the government is under. The Israeli public is unwilling to give up.
It looks like you cut out a little bit there, but I think your broader point is well taken, that it's very hard to tell an entire society that has sons and, you know, children and relatives in the military, literally with their lives on the line, that somehow we're going to have, you know, political considerations of the Biden administration endanger their sons. And I was just wondering the lessons we can learn here. A lot of people, a lot of my colleagues on the right have believed for a while that the left wants to get us involved in wars in order to create a draft. And I've always disagreed with that assumption, because I actually think they like not having skin in the game. I think if you actually had an Israel dynamic in America, I don't think they'd be able to do their political correctness. I'm curious your thoughts about that. If we could, you know, I'm not saying I'm in favor of a draft here. I just think the psychology works differently.
Yeah, look, I think that the problem of the United States having very, very large populations who are socially very distant from the military, it's been a problem for a long time, and it's just increasingly a problem. I think that Americans, you know, to the extent that they are looking to recover their national cohesion and national unity and the ability to make realistic foreign policy and security decisions, I think it's important that American families start participating in the military again. How we get there from here, I'm not sure. But
especially with the current policies in our military, yeah, it's a
for sure.
You know, a lot of our people aren't advising they join, and it's very sad. But that's the world we live in. One final thing before I let you go. Wanted to get your thoughts on Trump and Israel. I know I emailed you this New York Times article from an interview he did with a couple of Israeli journalists. Obviously, you know, he'd be, you know, much more predisposed to support Israel's operation by a mile over Biden. And he certainly was as president. Last couple months, he's been a little bit confusing, generally been very supportive. But then, you know, he has honed in on this talking point like, hey, you guys are really getting hammered in the press and the world opinion. You got to wrap this thing up. You got to do it quickly. What do you take from that? What do you think is behind Trump's comments?
Well, you know, I don't know Trump personally, so my speculation is of limited value here. But I would say that when Trump was talking about his achievement in breaking down the Hamas, I'm sorry, the ISIS caliphate, and putting an end to that, quickly is the word that he always uses. When he says quickly, I don't think that he means retreat quickly. I think he means when he says win quickly, he means win quickly. So look, like I say, I'd be happy to talk to him and ask him his opinions, but I wouldn't be rushed to assume that if he says Israel should win quickly, it means something that Israelis wouldn't agree with.
And face value, that makes sense. I mean, I'm not second guessing their leadership there because they're in a tough situation, just beleaguered by everything. But my old adage in politics is there's nothing there, you know, lukewarm hell never works for you. And that's sort of where they are, where they kind of went in strong, but not fully. And sometimes you just got to rip the Band-Aid off. If you're going to do it, go do it. You're going to get criticized anyway, so that's probably what needs to happen.
I don't think that there was ever a possibility that this war would be over in 6 months. If you go back and look at the both the government and the generals were saying from day one that this is a war that is going to last a year and maybe a few years. And what they were talking about then is not just the Gaza war, which I agree with you. It's being held up. I think it's primarily being held up by the Biden administration.
Sure.
But if Israel had full support from the United States without the problems that it's having right now, then probably the Gaza operation would be at the final stages and the Lebanon operation would be beginning.
Wow, that is certainly a very scary and we definitely appreciate your insights here. Again, Y Hezani on Twitter. Where else could people follow your work? And I particularly want people to take a look at some of your essays on the Old Testament. Your biblical writings, I think, are very worthy. It's all worthy of a whole discussion in and of itself.
Yeah, so my website, yoramchazony.org, Y-O-R-A-M-H-A-Z-O-N-Y, yoramchazony.org. For you know, my books and essays. People should also take a look at nationalconservatism.org. We have conferences coming up, big conferences for nationalist conservatives in Europe and in America. So stay tuned.
Well, we certainly need forward-looking conservative leaders. It's a little bit lacking here in this era. Thanks so much for what you do, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
So again, that was Yoram Hezani in Israel, and I figured, look, we would do a little bit of a change of pace today. He's a very thoughtful leader on a lot of issues. It's funny, he's Israeli, but he does a lot of work in America and Europe pushing national conservatism. But, you know, again, not this kind of just rote reactionary national populism, but actually with a... with a forward-looking agenda, smart guy, soft-spoken, but very forward-looking as well. So he has a lot of good resources. Godly man. He's got 9 kids, 2 in the military. There, I didn't even know that. I mean, I didn't talk to him before, so I had no idea that he was related to one of the hostages. And I think again, I mean, you know, you see you see how you could have an entire world, like, you know, the patriarch of Judaism, Abraham, to be against an entire world, that everyone just hones in on evil. I mean, literally, they are screwed. Without God's providence, they're screwed. Because between the militarily and politically, they're completely surrounded. Whatever they do, they're screwed. I mean, you can't be a pacifist. You can't go home. What are they supposed to do? They're not going to stop. Because how do you think October 7th happened to begin with? You know, they gave them Gaza, said, go knock yourself out there. They kicked out their own people from it, gave it to the Arabs. And this is what they did out of nowhere. So it's not like you can just go home and somehow they'll go away. And then you have Hezbollah, you have Iran, you have the Houthis, you have everything. And we have our own administration using their resources to screw with them. Again, this whole business of, oh, are you focused on America first or do you want to just give a bunch of aid to Israel? It's a straw man argument. Stay the hell out of it and let them do what they need to do. And we focus on what we need to do. We only need to give them diplomatic cover, which doesn't cost anything. That's what needs to be done from our end. But there is an interesting lesson there. I mean, I trust his instincts politically there. I don't know enough about their political parties, but it is interesting. You know, some of the lessons we talked about, universal military service. Again, with the military we have today, I wouldn't want that, but there is something to be said about that. And just the fact that even now, with all the relentless NGOs and the Biden administration funding of a color revolution, he's saying it's a relatively small number of people there that the country is behind them. And this is what I always say. Does America have to get as bad as Israel in terms of the severity of the threat to your lives? Because right now, like, the border is still too subtle. You don't see it outside your window for the most part. Most people, they're just gradually building up our communities with these, you know, violent third worlders from Venezuela and elsewhere. But eventually they reach critical mass. And then it's too late. So, you know, Israel's public is finally on the right side, but at a very painful cost. Do we have to get to that point in America? And that's a scary thought. That really is. Because, I mean, I don't think you could imagine living like that. I mean, when you're talking about 100,000 people evacuated in a country that size for 6 months ongoing. They're like, oh, Israel's being a warmonger starting up with Lebanon. I mean, no. I mean, they would just walk away from it. But they can't. Because, you know, when you have Hezbollah with the support of the Biden administration constantly firing rockets and engaging in these attacks, you might not see an October 7th level, but it's enough that you can't live there. You know, like he tweaked what I was saying. He's like, that's not low intensity. And then finally, just the fact that what's scary is how he noted just the merging of the radical left with Islam in America. And it's clout. It's tremendous clout. You know, there's one thing, hey, you know, I don't want to give money to Israel. Oh, that's fine. But no, I mean, Biden is obsessed. That administration is engaged there more than almost anything domestically. Because evil people gravitate to evil. And there is nothing so evil as the cause of Hamas. Now, it's our job not to import their people and their mentality into this country. We'll focus a little bit on the vaccines. There's a lot of stuff tomorrow I want to get to, as well as some state stuff. As always, you could join our ConAction teams, conaction.network. We can't really fix the world, but we can fix our communities. And that's what we need to do, changing one red state at a time. Till tomorrow, God bless you all, and thank you for listening.